Then 2018, our family had a family reunion in north of Sacramento, California. So we were taking Interstate 80 from Chicago. That's where you first get on it, all the way across what really became the Donner Pass. Just to give you an overview of that story, I was helped a lot by a book named Bob Mayer, Donner Party: Anatomy of a Catastrophe. He was a former Green Beret, and he shows a number of areas that combined together for this whole thing to implode, for it to become a tragedy. In spring of 1846, a group of immigrants departed west for California. Rather than take the usual route, they decided to take a shorter new route. The Hastings cutoff, the delays from taking that route caused them to reach the last obstacle, the Sierra Nevada Mountains, so late in the season that they became trapped by heavy snowfall and were forced to spend the winter starving and freezing. Some of the group resorted to cannibalism. Eventually, about half the party was rescued in the spring of 1847. So let's look at some of the characters here. I was much helped by the book by Eliza Donner Houghton. She was only 3 years old when they set off from Springfield, Illinois, but she lived till 1922, so she was able to put together some of this history. The sad part is she put a lot of this history together to correct the record, because they had been maligned. They embellished the whole idea of cannibalism so much that she wanted to set the record straight in her appendix to this work. So the other parties were, on the left, James and Margaret Reed, and on the right, that's George Donner and his brother, also set out with them. The histories kind of contradict, and I can only go with what Eliza said. I would trust her. She said that her father was 62 when they left Springfield, Illinois. One source says Reed was 62, but Wikipedia said he was born in 1800. That would make him either 46 or 45, depending if this is after or before his birthday, before April when they set out. But what was the draw? The fertile farmlands of Central California drew a steady stream of settlers in the 1840s. And in the spring of 1846, several families from Springfield, Illinois joined the westward migration. The families of brothers George and Jacob Donner and local businessman James Reed left Springfield on April 14th, 1846. The reason they had to leave about that time, it had to be sufficiently far enough along in the spring that they could set out, but early enough you had to be over the pass before it was going to snow. But the winter of 1846 was one of the worst winters ever to hit the Sierra Nevada range in California, which we'll talk about in a moment. Now, James Reed had actually fought in a war in the Illinois area, and one of the people he knew at that time, if you think about it, Springfield, Illinois, would have been Abraham Lincoln. So with the addition of roughly a dozen teamsters, now a teamster is a person who drives the coach, the wagon, and employees, this initial party numbered some 31 people, and within a month, the Donners and Reeds had reached Independence, Missouri. There on May 12th, they became a part of a main wagon train headed west. Well, the reason for Independence, Missouri is you wanted to get as far along as you could using streams in many cases and so on, because it was sometimes easier to transport things by river, by water, than by land. And Independence, Missouri was a very common place for people headed west to come together. The states along the Mississippi were but sparsely settled in 1846, yet the fame of the fruitfulness, the healthfulness, and almost the tropical beauty of the land bordering the Pacific tempted the members of the Donner Party to leave their homes. Now, commonly it is called the Donner Party. It could better be called the Reed Party or the Donner-Reed Party. It only became the Donner Party when they decided to leave the main path and take this Hastings cutoff, which they had learned about in a book that talked about A Traveler's Guide to Oregon and California, and mentioned this shortcut, which we'll get into later, which was a very bad piece of the puzzle. of this whole picture of why this became a tragedy. So early in April 1846, they set out from Springfield. They got to Independence. The expedition of the Donner Party and its tragic fate is the book that I'll quote the most. After careful investigations and considerations, my father, George Donner, and his elder brother, Jacob, decided to join the westward migration, selecting California as their destination. My mother was in accord with my father's wishes and helped him to carry out his plan. So she says here he was 62, large, fine-looking, and in perfect health. The preparations made for the journey by my parents were practical, so there's a list of all that you would have for every person that is going. Just give you an example. 75 pounds of meat for each for a 4-month journey. So if anything went wrong, they were already going to be in danger of not having the proper foods. Cows were selected to furnish milk on the way. A few young beef cattle, 5 saddle horses, and a good watchdog completed the list of livestock. After carefully calculating the requisite amount of provisions, Father stored in his wagons a quantity that was deemed more than sufficient to last until we should reach California. Seed and implements for use on the prospective farms in the new country. A liberal sum of money for meeting incidental expenses and replenishing supplies on the journey. If need be, was stored in the compartments of 2 wide buckskin girdles to be worn in concealment about the person. April 15th, 1846, the core of the party sets out from Springfield, Illinois, and on the 12th of May, they set out from Independence, Missouri, the starting point of Western migration. Elizabeth Donner said, or Eliza Donner said, as we drove up Main Street, delayed immigrants waved us a light-hearted goodbye. And as we approached the building of the American Tract Society, and I thought this is interesting, here's a little detail that you won't find in any movie of the Donner family tragedy. Members of the American Tract Society in Independence, Missouri, their agents came to our wagons and put into the hand of each child a New Testament and gave to each adult a Bible and also tracts to distribute among the heathen in the benighted land to which we were going. Also, a minister of the gospel accompanied them. And they were Sabbatarians. If you study out the history, it was very, very common for people not to work on Sunday. However, because of the emergencies along the way, there were times in which a Sabbath could not be observed. An important background event, though, that you got to keep in mind, the Mexican-American War was going on. Lost in the story is an event most Americans have forgotten, the Mexican-American War. Percentage-wise, says the author, in terms of casualties, it was the bloodiest war in history for our military. Technically speaking, the Donner Party was immigrating to Mexico, not another part of the United States. So these states still belong to Mexico, but Mexico was welcoming people to come in to settle some of this land. So they were headed west in the midst of a war between the United States and Mexico. Now the author, the guy I told you who was a Green Beret, says, I covered this war extensively in Duty Honor County, West Point to Mexico, so I won't give a historical lesson here, but point out how this affected the Donner Party. In 1846, Mexico technically owned New Mexico, Utah, Nevada, Arizona, California, and most of Colorado. Because of the Texas War of Independence, there was a debate about how much of Texas was Texas and how much was Mexico. So, back to Eliza's account, during our first few days in the territory of Kansas, we passed over good roads and through fields of May blossoms, musical with the hum of bees and the songs of birds. Some of the party rode horseback, others walked in advance of the train, but each father drove his own family team. We little folks sat in the wagons with our dolls, watching the huge white-covered prairie schooners coming from Santa Fe to Independence for merchandise. 18th of June, William Russell gives up command of the party, trading in his wagon for mules to travel faster along with Edwin Bryant and some others. So you already have some people who are leaving this party. They want to get there faster, so they leave wagons in exchange for a mule so that they're not as hindered. But as they go along, other people that are interested in this migration also join the crew. So there are some 81 people at first in what becomes known as the Donner Party. So writing to a friend, June 16, 1846, we are now on the Platte, 200 miles from Fort Laramie, that's Wyoming. Our journey so far has been pleasant. The roads have been good and food plentiful. The water for part of the way has been indifferent, but at no time have our cattle suffered for it. Wood is now very scarce, but buffalo chips are excellent. They kindle quickly and retain heat surprisingly. So that was their source for fires, buffalo chips. We had this morning buffalo steaks broiled upon them. They had the same flavor they would have had upon hickory coals. We feel no fear of Indians. Our cattle graze quietly around our encampment, unmolested. Two or three men will go hunting 20 miles from camp, and last night two of our men lay out in the wilderness rather than ride their horses after a hard chase. Indeed, if I do not experience something far worse than I have yet done, I shall say the trouble is an all in getting started. Well, little did she know. Our wagons have not needed much repair, and I cannot yet tell in what respects they could be improved. Certain it is, they cannot be too strong. Our preparations for the journey might have been in some respects bettered. June 27th, the party in which the Donners and Rees travel, now called the Boggs Company, named for its leader Lilburn W. Boggs, a former governor of Missouri, arrives at Fort Laramie. James Reed meets James Clyman. So picture this in your mind. This is such an important part of this event. He meets James Clyman. Apparently he had known him from before, but Clyman is coming from California East. And so he is aware of what is called this shortcut and warns them, do not take that shortcut. I was able to get across it on a horse. You're not going to be able to do so. So Clyman was an old mountaineer who has just come by horse from California with Lansford Hastings. Hastings is the one that wrote the book, A Traveler's Guide to Oregon and California, and talks about this new shortcut that became known as the Hastings Shortcut. They came by way of a new route, which will soon be known as the Hastings Cutoff. Clyman urges the immigrants to avoid the Hastings Cutoff and take the regular route instead of the one that Hastings is recommending. But Jim Reed thinks that he can do it. And in many ways, he really is the leader of this group. So they pass the Independence Rock on July 17th. The party receives a letter from Hastings saying he will meet them at Fort Bridger and guide them. Well, it's interesting how they got these messages. Sometimes a piece of paper would be tacked to a stump of a tree or whatever, giving them communication. The problem is Hastings says that he would meet them, and in a couple of cases he never shows up. July 18th, the party crosses the Continental Divide, and I well remember that because when we were going to across California, and the Continental Divide is here in Wyoming, Interstate 80 across Wyoming is so high up. I don't know any part of that interstate that is less than 6,000 feet above sea level. So you'll see a sign that says, this is the Continental Divide, and you hardly know it. Because the whole thing seems flat, you're just so high up in Wyoming. At Fort Bridger, which was at this time a mere camp or trading post, the party heard much commendation bestowed upon a new route via Salt Lake, so they keep hearing about the Hastings Cutoff. Fort Bridger is the place in Wyoming that we're mentioning here. And the Hastings Cutoff is, of course, a red route that you see below, and it takes you by under the Great Salt Lake and through the Great Salt Lake Desert, which we saw when we were going out to California. And I'd only flown over it. In fact, the day that Betty and I flew out to Montana because we were getting married, there was a nice sunset over the Salt Lake, but I had never driven through here. I've driven from north to south when I was moving to Louisiana, so I hadn't seen this Salt Lake Desert that is all part of this shortcut. Instead of sand, you actually have salt for miles and miles. But it's supposed to cut off 300 miles from this trip. And they think, well, if I could get ahead, 3 weeks ahead of the other people taking the normal California trail, that's inviting to me, not knowing that by doing this and having to cut a new path through the Wasatch Mountains of Utah, they were actually slowed down 3 weeks behind the people taking the California Trail. But there's another thing you got to keep in mind about why the California Trail went where it did. In those days, if things are driven, pulled by oxen or cattle or whatever, the one thing that you have to have is water. You got to keep these animals fed. And the problem that they had by taking this south route in a desert, it played havoc with not only the persons who were going, but the oxen. In fact, it got so bad that after a while, some oxen escaped and just ran off. On the 19th of July, we reached a little sandy river and there found four distinct companies encamped in neighborly groups. Most of them were listed for Oregon and were resting their cattle preparatory to entering upon the long, dry drive of 40 miles known as Greenwood's Cutoff. There, my father and others deliberated over a new route to California. They were led to do so by an open letter which had been delivered to our company on the 17th by a special messenger on horseback. So the letter was written by Lansford Hastings, the author of Travel Among the Rocky Mountains through Oregon and California, and it was dated and addressed at the headwaters of the Sweetwater to all California immigrants now on the road, and intimated that on account of the war between Mexico and the United States, the government of California would probably oppose the entrance of American immigrants to its territory, and urged these on the way to California to consecrate their numbers and strength and to take the new and better route, which he had explored from Fort Bridger by way of the south end of Salt Lake. Well, when this cutoff was originally planned, the area was known. The fact of the matter was that Hastings had never actually taken this shortcut before until the time that these settlers, migrants, set off from Missouri. It was the first time he had actually seen this. So by them heeding his advice and thinking they're going to save time, they're actually getting themselves into trouble because they're taking the advice of a single person. And I'll get into that in a minute. But it emphasized the statement that this new route was nearly 200 miles shorter than the old one by way of Fort Hall in the headwaters of the Ogden's River, and he himself would remain at Fort Bridger to give further information and to conduct the immigrants through to the settlement. So the proposition seemed feasible, and after some cool deliberation and discussion, a party was formed to take the new route. Now, this is the point at which George Donner becomes the head captain of the company, and it was more because he was easier to get along with, and people preferred him rather than Jim Reed, and so from that time it was known as the Donner Party. All the companies broke camp and left a little sandy on the 20th of July. The Oregon Division, with a section for California, took the right-hand trail for Fort Hall. They would go up north, Fort Hall, and the others took this shortcut. So after parting from us, Mr. Thornton made the following note in his journal, July 20th, 1846. The Californians were much elated and in fine spirits with the prospect of better and nearer road to the country of their destination. Mrs. George Donner, however, was an exception. So George Donner's wife, she was gloomy, sad, and dispirited in view of the fact that her husband and others could think of leaving the old road and confide in the statement of a man of whom they knew nothing, but was probably some selfish adventurer. July 31st, the party leaves Fort Bridger to take the Hastings Cutoff. They cross the Wasatch Mountains of Utah with many delays. Well, that's a beautiful, beautiful drive if you're on Interstate 80. And the road is, of course, now very, very clear. Back then, they had to actually cut the paths through the trees of the Wasatch Mountains, and there were huge delays going west. So Proverbs 15, verse 22, without counsel, plans go awry. But that proverb also says, in the multitude of counselors they are established. And they certainly did not have a multitude of counsel in regards to taking this shortcut. So Bob Mayer, from the book Donner Party, Anatomy of a Catastrophe, lesson. We've all been given advice about shortcuts. The deeper lesson is to always filter advice through motivation and experience. As far as experience, does a person given the advice know what they're talking about? Hastings had been west, but not on the cutoff. His book did give quite a bit of practical advice and described the country glowingly. Reading it, one gets a feel of almost a tourist advertisement for California and a treatise of hatred for the Mexican authorities. But the lack of detail about the cutoff makes it surprising that one would seize upon it for the journey of a lifetime. By lack of detail, I mean that the entire discussion of the cutoff in the book consisted of one sentence. The most direct route to for the California immigrants would be to leave the Oregon route about 200 miles east from Fort Hall, thence bearing west-southwest to the Salt Lake, and thence continuing down to the Bay of San Francisco by the route just described, end quote. Well, I did find the book that Hastings wrote. It is available on the internet. And that's what's so nice about in our day and age. We can get so many of these books that are 150 years old, and you can download them and read them. So Lansford Hastings, The Immigrant's Guide. Well, that's not much. The Donner Party would have more contact with Hastings than just a book. The bottom line is that the Donner Party bet its lives on a single sentence in a book read by James Reed. August 30th, the party sets off across the Great Salt Lake Desert, experiencing more delays. A new inventory, taken about this time, disclosed the fact that the company's stock of supplies is insufficient to carry it through to California. There's a I've watched many a YouTube documentary on this whole story, and there were three college kids that decided they would walk the whole Hastings cutoff, and one of them, listening to him talk about this, and he got 2 miles into this salt desert and was already ready to quit. I mean, think about the time that this was. It was still very, very hot. And 2 miles in, he just simply did not know how they were able to cross this, because the wheels of the chariots, the wheels of the things pulling them along would continually get stuck in the sand and have to be pulled out. It was a drain upon the oxen, and they didn't have enough water anyway. 26th of September, the party finally rejoins the California Trail at the Humboldt River. October 5th, 1846, while struggling up a sandy hill at Iron Point, Nevada, the Reed and Graves teams became entangled, so somehow their vehicles get wrapped up together and a fight breaks out, because by this time the tempers are very short and the teamsters, the ones that drive, are usually the ones that get angry. And the teamster for the other family is named John Snyder, gets off and starts to whip the oxen and gets Jim Reed really upset that his temper is so short. And he says, "You gotta stop." And John Snyder is angry at him, so he turned the whip around and hit him over the head with the wooden part of the whip and cracked his head enough that it was bleeding pretty profusely. And so Jim Reed's wife runs in between. This is the account that I trust the most, trying to get him to stop, and he brings the whip down upon her, and by that time Jim Reed has had it, and he pulls out a knife and stabs Snyder in the chest with his hunting knife, and Snyder stumbles some feet up the hill and dies. So a man named Louis Kesselberg once suggested to hang Reed, and they were ready to hang him. You know, justice must be done. But the immigrants decided to banish Reed, who at first refuses to leave but then agrees. So they were going to send him out in the desert without a horse or anything. And finally, they assent to give him a horse, and his wife pleads with him to go because we're going to need supplies. So where would he go? He would get into California, and the place you go is to Sutter's Fort to get supplies and then come back to assist the people that are coming over. So it was advantageous to the Reed family that Jim Reed left and another man accompanied him, and they took off on horses. And they got across the path before the winter storm started to come. October 6, 1846, Reed heads west. The following day, he overtakes the Donners, who have moved ahead of the rest of the party. One of Reed's teamsters, Walter Heron, has been traveling with the Donners. He decides to accompany Reed to California. Knowing that time is running out, the immigrants travel as quickly as possible along the Humboldt River, because they're already greatly delayed, and they need to get across this path before the snow starts to come. Unfortunately, and in God's providence, this year the snow was going to come very, very early. So Bob Mayer says of this, they're getting across the desert, they need to make up for lost time. They've lost a lot of oxen. In fact, the Indians had slaughtered numerous of their oxen. It got so bad that many of the people were ordered out of the buggies, if I could use that term, and had to walk alongside. And there was a man who was in very bad shape, an elderly man, his name was Hardcoop, who just simply wasn't going to be able to walk mile after mile after mile alongside of a wagon. So Mayer's conclusion is a tipping point for the Donner Party came on October 7, 1846 as they moved toward the Sierra Nevadas along the Humboldt River with worn out animals, everyone who had to get off the wagons and walk. One of the men owning a wagon forced an elderly man, Hardcoop, who had been traveling with him, out of his wagon. Hardcoop tried walking on severely swollen feet. Unable to keep up, he limped along, pleading with every wagon for someone to take him in. No one did. Hardcoop sat down under a large bush, pleading still. They left him behind. This meant the Donner Party had no leader and was no longer a group. It was everyone for themselves, and that led to what would happen in the Sierra Nevada Mountains. From his book, An Anatomy of a Catastrophe, October 11, 1846, at night, Paiute Indians killed 21 of the Donner Party's oxen. Shortly thereafter, the Indians steal another 18 oxen and wound several others. More than 100 of the party's cattle are now gone. October 13th, one man decides to cache his wagon. Well, that means that you're leaving it there in the desert to come back to it later. The word actually means to store away in hiding or for future use. The two men who stay behind to help him come back without him, saying he was killed by Indians. But the matter of fact was that one of them had murdered him. October 25th, a small relief party arrives from California with 7 mules of provisions, accompanied by 2 Native American guides. So Sutter, the man who the fort is named after, an immigrant himself, was very, very kind to them. He gave them provisions and says, you can pay me back when you get to California, and lent them these animals and also 2 Indian guides. And his charge to them is, I need to have the oxen back as soon as you can. So the party cannot make it over the Truckee Pass. So Truckee, California is where the last really stopping place before you start to head over the Sierra Nevada. It's a beautiful place. And I was interested in it because all of the last 20 or more years, I've always wanted to go down to see Lake Tahoe, which really wasn't far out of the way. So me and the family drove 15, 16 miles down there to take a look at that. So the whole area is very, very nice, but it's, of course, so historic. So Eliza says of this, up and up we toiled until we reached an altitude of 6,000 feet. So now they're starting to go up the Sierra Mountain Pass. and were within 10 miles of our companions at the lake when the intense cold drove us into camp at Prosser Creek in Alder Creek Valley, a picturesque and sheltered nook 2.5 miles in length and 3/4 of a mile in width. But no one observed the picturesque grandeur of the forest-covered mountains which hem it in on the north and west, nor that eastward and southward it looks out across plateau to the Washoe Mountains 20 miles away, because a piercing wind was driving storm clouds toward us, and those who understood their threatening aspect, here come the clouds, realized that 21 persons, 8 of them helpless children, were there at the mercy of the pitiless Storm King. So that's the name that they give to these storms, the Storm King. The teams were hurriedly unhooked, the tents pitched, and the men and the women began collecting material for more suitable quarters. Some fell trees, some loft off the branches of some with oxen, dragged the logs into position. There was enough building material on the ground for a good-sized foundation, 4 logs deep. When night stopped the work, the moon and stars came out before we went to bed, yet the following morning the ground was covered with snow 2 to 3 feet in depth. And so this is before November, and it was rare to get 3 feet of snow in late October in this area, but many historians believe this is one of the worst winters ever to hit the Sierra Nevada mountains. So the snow had to be shoveled from the exposed beds before their occupants could rise. I remember well that new day. All plans for log cabins had to be abandoned. There wasn't even time to build log cabins. There was no sheltered nook for shivering children. So Father lifted George and me onto a log, and Mother tucked her buffalo robe around us, saying, "Sit here until we have a better place for you." There we sat snug and dry, chatting and twisting our heads about, watching the hurry and anxious workers. Those not busy at the wagons were helping the builders to construct a permanent camp. When we awoke the following morning, little heaps of snow lay here and there upon the floor. No threshold could be seen, only a snowbank reaching up to the white plain beyond, where every sound was muffled and every object was blurred by falling flakes. Father's face was very grave. He's starting to get scared. His morning caress had all its wonted tenderness, but the merry twinkle was gone from his eye and the gladsome note from his voice. For 8 consecutive days, the fatal snow fell with but few short intermissions, 8 days in which there was nothing to break the monotony of torturing, inactive endurance except the necessity of gathering wood, keeping the fires, and cutting anew the steps which led upward as the snow increased in depth. Well, as I was reading some different accounts, and they had interviewed people who survived this, just a little more than half of the people survived this and got to California, that was one of the most difficult things to endure, with just waiting at the bottom of this tent, this cabin that they were putting together, surrounded by snow, and I'll show you how deep the snow was in a moment, and inactive because they were starting to run out of food, so they had to not unnecessarily burn too much energy, and it just made the days very, very long, but at the same time, there was part of the day in which they would have to go out and get logs for firewood. All in the camp fared alike, and all were on short ration. 3 of our men became dispirited, said that they were too weak and hungry to gather wood, and did not care how soon death would put an end to their miseries. The out-of-door duties would have fallen wholly upon my Aunt Betsy's 2 sons and on John Baptiste. Now, he's the guy that had joined them along the way and was a very helpful guide and was so helpful to this party, and he did survive and get into California. They, however, hid their fears from their children, the parents did, even from each other, and helped to gather fuel, hunt cattle, and keep camp. Axes were dull, green wood was hard to cut and harder to carry, whether through loose, dry snow or over crust made slippery by sleet and frost. Cattle tracks were covered over. Some of the poor creatures had perished under bushes where they sought shelter, so the cattle were dying. They were trying to seek shelter and perished. A few had become bewildered and strayed. Others were found under trees and snow pits, which they themselves had made by walking round and round the trunks to keep from being snowed under. These starvelings were shot to end their sufferings, and also with the hope that their hides and fleshless bones might save the lives of our snow-beleaguered party. Every part of the animals was saved for food. The locations of the carcasses were marked so that they could be brought piece by piece into camp, and even the green hides were spread against the huts to serve in case of need. Well, by this time, one of this party, we're very thankful for this, Patrick Brain, started a diary about November 20th in 1846, which I was able to find last night, and I was able to download. It's only about 25 pages, but the whole of it, almost the whole of it, was printed in the Los Angeles newspaper because this story so fascinated people in California and later on all over the West, what these immigrants had endured. 15th of December, the first member of the party dies from malnutrition. 16th of December, the strongest members of the party set out on snowshoes to make it through the pass to Sutter's Fort. So there were 15 people, and they set out over, you know, they had put together some kind of a snowshoe made out of animal bones and skins and so on, trying to get over and find a way to get to Sutter's Fort. Well, you can imagine, I mean, it's over 100 miles, even if you got over that mountain, to get to Sacramento, which where Sutter's Fort was. So they became known as the Forlorn Hope, and it may be the most depressing part of the whole story. Although we were so meagerly informed, it is well that my reader should at this point become familiar with the experiences of the expedition known as the Forlorn Hope, and also the various measures taken for our relief when our precarious condition was made known to the good people of California. It will be remembered that the Forlorn Hope was a party of 15 which, as John Baptiste reported to us, made the last unaided attempt to cross the mountains. Words cannot picture, nor mind conceive, more torturing hardships and privations than were endured by that little band on its way to the settlement. So they were supposed to be able to get, as they thought, to the top of the mountain range within 4 days, but the snow just kept driving at them. So they left the camp on the 16th of December with scant rations for 6 days, hoping in that time to force its way to Bear Valley and there find game that they can hunt. Well, the other thing that they could do down below is they could fish. And I'm from Montana, so I can understand what their problem was. In Michigan, if you fish in many of our streams, the water's a lot more cloudy. It looks sometimes more dirty. Out west, it's completely clear. And these people did not have experience, being from Illinois, to fish in this clear stream. Because if the shadow crosses the stream and that fish sees you, it's gone. So they were never successful to catch fish. They just didn't have the experience. They could actually see them down there and had to give up. So this is the type of things they had to go through just to get food. The storms, which had been so pitiless that the mountain camps followed the unprotected refugees with seemingly fiendish fury. After the first day from camp, its members could no longer keep together on their marches. The stronger broke the trail and the rest followed to night camp as best they could. On the third day, Stanton's sight failed because there's so much snow, there's so much white, you become snow blind. And he begged piteously to be led. Lead me, I can't see. But soon realizing the heart-rending plight of his companions, he uncomplainingly submitted to his fate. 3 successive nights he staggered into camp long after the others had finished their stinted meal. Always he was shivering from cold, sometimes wet with sleet and rain. It is recorded that at no time had the party allowed more than an ounce of food per meal to any individual, yet the rations gave out on the night of the 22nd of December. While they were still in a wilderness of snow peaks, Mr. Eddy only was better provided, and looking over his pack that morning for the purpose of throwing away any useless article, he had found out that his wife had snuck some meat into his pack. He unexpectedly found a small bag containing about a half a pound of dried bear meat. Fastened to the meat was a pencil note from his wife begging him to save the hidden treasure until his hour of direst need, since it might then be the means of saving his life. The note was signed, "Your own dear Eleanor." With tenderest emotion, he slipped the food back, resolving to do the dear one's bidding, trusting that she and their children might live until he should return for them. December 17, 1846, Charles Berger and young William Murphy are unable to keep up with the snowshoers and return to the camp. That's because these young boys thought that they didn't need snowshoes and they would try to follow along in the path that was created. The problem was it was just impossible to walk across the snow without snowshoes. So 15 continued on, 5 young women, 9 men, and a 12-year-old Lemuel Murphy. Around this date or the next, the snowshoers get over the summit. December 21st, the snowshoers have made it over the pass, but are battling deep snow. One member sits down, smokes his pipe, and tells them to go on. You know, he's first saying, "Can you lead me? Can you help me?" and so on. And then he sits down and starts smoking a pipe and tells them to go on. He'll catch up, but he stays there, and of course he dies. The following morning, while the others were preparing to leave camp, Stanton sat beside the smoldering fire, smoking his pipe. When ready to go forth, they asked him if he was coming, and he replied, "Yes, I'm coming soon." Those were his parting words to his friends and his greeting to the angel of death. He never left that fireside, and his companions were too feeble to return for him when they found he did not come into the camp. 24 hours later, the members of that hapless little band threw themselves upon the desolate waste of snow to ponder the problems of life and death, to search each the other's face for answers to the question their lips dared not frame. Fathers who had left their families and mothers who had left their babes wanted to go back and die with them, if die they must. But Mr. Eddy and the Indians, those who had crossed a range with Stanton, declared that they would push on to the settlement. Then Mary Graves, in whose young heart were still whisperings of hope, courageously said, "I too will go on, for to go back and hear the cries of hunger from my little brothers and sisters is more than I can stand. I shall go as far as I can, let the consequences be what they may." Her father would not let his daughter proceed alone, and finally all decided to make a final supreme effort. Yet, think of it, they were without one morsel of food. Even the wind seemed to hold its breath as the suggestion was made that were one to die, the rest might live. So I'm going to read from Patrick Breen's diary, and I'm going to pass over the other parts of this narrative because they're not really fitting for a Sunday school, but there's parts of this diary that are edifying. He said, "Began this day to read the 30 days of prayer. May Almighty God grant the request of an unworthy sinner that I am. Amen. December 24th, Christmas Eve. The snowshoers can go no further. They draw lots to decide who to kill and eat, but can't kill the loser. So they draw, and one person loses, and they don't have the courage to harm him. But members begin to die. Then the suggestion was made that lots be cast, and whoever drew the longest slip should be the sacrifice." December 25th, back to the diary. "Offered our prayers to God this Christmas morning. The prospect is appalling, but hope in God. Amen." December 31st, 1846. Patrick Breen's diary. "Last of the year, may we, with God's help, spend the coming year better than the past, which we purpose to do if Almighty God will deliver us from our present dreadful situation, which is our prayer if the will of God sees it fitting for us. Amen." January 9th, the snowshoers come upon the 2 weakened and exhausted Native Americans who tried to escape. And I'll leave it there. I'm not going to describe it. 17th of January, the snowshoers are taken in by a Native American village for the rest of the party on the other side of the mountains. It's uncertain when they resorted to cannibalism of those who died from malnutrition and or the cold. With a thrill of emotion too intense for words, with a prayer in his heart too fervent for utterance, Mr. Eddy turned his tearful eyes toward Mary and saw her weeping like a child. A moment later, that man and that woman who had once said that they knew not how to pray were kneeling beside that newly found track, pleading in broken accents to the giver of all life for a manifestation of his power to save their starving band. Long restrained tears were still streaming down the cheeks of both and soothing their anxious hearts. And as they arose after this prayer, they actually saw a deer. They had not proceeded far before they saw a large buck about 80 yards distant. Mr. Eddy raised his rifle and for some time tried to bring it to bear upon the deer, but such was his extreme weakness that he could not. He breathed a little, changed his manner of holding the gun, and made another effort. Again, his weakness prevented him from being able to hold upon it. He heard a low, suppressed sobbing behind him and turning around saw Mary Graves weeping and in great agitation, her head bowed and her hands upon her face, alarmed lest she should cause the deer to run. Mr. Eddy begged her to be quiet, which she was, after exclaiming, "Oh, I'm afraid you will not kill it." He brought the gun to his face a third time and elevated the muzzle above the deer, let it descend until he saw the animal through the sight. When the rifle cracked, Mary immediately wept aloud, exclaiming, "Oh, merciful God, you've missed it." Mr. Eddy assured her that he had not, and that the rifle was upon it the moment of firing, and that in addition to this, the animal had dropped its tail between its legs, which this animal always does when wounded. His belief was speedily confirmed. A deer ran a short distance and fell, and the two eager watchers hastened to it as fast as their weakened condition would allow. So they were able to get the deer, dress it, and so on. And they actually were able to make it back to camp after an entire month out here in the winter snow. Early on the morning of January 18th, Mr. Richie Johnson, Vero, and Kaiser, equipped with horses and other necessities, hurried away to bring in the refugees together with their comrades who had gone on before. So there were four attempts to rescue the people from California. Sometimes they were delayed by the snow, but the biggest thing that hindered them was anybody who was young and was able was fighting in the Mexican-American War, they just did not have the manpower. But another problem is, when Jim Reed had left this group, they were sitting pretty good. They thought they had the supplies, the animals, and so on. And it wasn't as urgent, in his mind, as it actually, in fact, was. So this picture is really telling. It's from the year 1870. This is where these trees were cut off. When they were camping there, that meant that that snow was that high. So the snow hit 22 feet. And in order to get firewood, they were way up here. They actually had built steps to get them up the snow. And when the rescuers got there, it was hard to find them because they couldn't see anybody until somebody would peek out the hole where the smoke from the campfire would come through that opening and yell that we're down here. But that gives you an idea of how bad that was. So 22 feet of snow, and the people that are camped are down below. So the 19th of February, the first relief makes it over the mountains. Existing war between Mexico and the United States was keeping California in a disturbed condition. Most of the able-bodied male immigrants had enlisted under Captain Fremont as soon as they reached the country and were still on duty in the southern part of the province. So they were having trouble finding the people to be able to get over. By this time, word had gotten out that there were people that were trapped in the mountains because they kept enough inventory. They knew that other people had made it from Illinois and various states surrounding it, and they knew that there were a number of people that had to be trapped up in the mountains. And so word did get out, but in the meantime, it was disastrous for those who were behind. While Captain Kearns at Sutter Fort was sending messengers to different points, and Mrs. Sinclair was collecting clothing to replace the tattered garments of the members of the Forlorn Hope, her husband dispatched an open letter to the people of San Francisco, describing the arrival of the survivors of the Forlorn Hope and the heart-rending condition of those remaining in the mountains. He urged immediate action and offered his services for individual work or to cooperate with the government relief or any parties that might be preparing to go out with Reed and McCutcheon, who were known to be endeavoring to raise a second expedition. So finally, the fourth expedition was April 29th. The last surviving member of the Donner Party arrives at Sutter's Fort. So the Donner Party had the most casualties. They lost everybody. George Donner was sick. He was dying. His wife refused to abandon her husband. The relief party was there. They wanted to take her out, and she says, "I'm not going to abandon him." When he finally passed away, she made a makeshift grave for him, and then she headed out, and she never lasted 24 hours, and she had become so wet, freezing and so on, that she succumbed to it. So only the children of the Donner Party survived, including Eliza, who wrote this work. All of the Breen family, that was Patrick Breen's diary, they all survived, and all of the Reed family survived, and of course Jim did because he was kicked out of the group. Well, Bob Mayer brings another application to us from this. Throughout the journey, one gets the feeling the Donner Party was on an inexorable path to disaster. Yet there were numerous points where a decision could have changed someone's fate, whether it be to not take the Hastings cutoff, to turn back in Utah when Hastings told them to wait, to let go of their extraneous possessions and make the best possible time in order to make it across the desert and through the Sierra Nevadas. The inability to make these earlier decisions led those in the party to make decisions that were immoral, homicide, cannibalism, that they had never contemplated. While the weather lowered the final boom on the Donner Party, this catastrophe shows human error. And I would add, this is my input, and I would add lack of prayer clearly playing a part. So I don't know the spiritual condition of many of these people, but they certainly, in the end, cried upon the name of the Lord. And we hope and pray that God have mercy. But the thing that's a warning to us is, you know, I was thinking about Pilgrim's Progress when I was putting this together. And you have Christian with that burden on his back, and he's told to go toward the Wicket Gate. And he receives counsel from worldly wise men, and the counsel is very detrimental to his getting to the Wicket Gate. And you learn from this how important, not just a counselor who knows what he's talking about, but a multitude of counselors. And unfortunately, this story has fascinated so many people because they embellished the whole thing about cannibalism, which Eliza tries to show in the appendix of her work. It wasn't as bad as it was represented to be. So it's fascinated people over the years and so on. And I had three different biographies, and I'm going through it, and I want to know the spiritual condition of these people. But it at least shows the common grace that when they were heading out from Independence, Missouri, the American Tract Society would give them testaments to the children, Bibles to the adults, and tracts for the people who sit in darkness and have never known the light of the gospel. But the other thing that certainly teaches us is there was a price that was paid in the past that we often forget that has allowed us to enjoy the luxuries that we do in our day. The settlement of the West in many cases was very, very difficult. And people paid a huge price. And with that, I'll close because it's after 2 o'clock.